Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We don't hear as much about the Korean War compared to, say, World War II or Vietnam. But on the show today, we'll talk about why that's the case and how the war helped shape today's military. On the phone with us today, Thomas McKelvey Cleaver. His new book is titled Holding the Line, The Naval Air Campaign in Korea. And it's the product of 25 years of research. It's a fascinating book. He's been a published writer for the past 40 years, has had a lifelong interest in the Korean War. He's a regular contributor to Flight International magazine, written several books. So as we talk with him, think about it. What were you taught about the Korean War? What questions do you have about the changes to aircraft, perhaps, during those years? Love to have you part of the conversation. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Thomas McKelvey Cleaver, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, we had a little more interest in our community about the Korean War because a guy by the name of Daryl Krenz, a member of our community, was in the Korean War, and he was captured and survived capture. He was a bazooka operator, survived capture and a death march and 3.5 years as a POW.
He was one of the ones that must have gotten captured in the Great Bug Out.
Yeah, and so, there's interest in our community, I think, because of Daryl. But why is the Korean War so interesting to you?
Because it's kind of the progenitor of everything that happened since. World War II is the last war that we, quote-unquote, won in what people consider what people think of when they use the word won. It's a war that... It wasn't a war. It was a police action, which was strictly due to politics at the time. The Truman administration was having arguments with the Republicans in Congress who were looking forward to the 1950 midterms, where they hoped to overturn the results of the 48 election, and so they didn't want to do a lot of cooperating. So they put it up through the UN, which only happened because the Russians hadn't been there since January. They were protesting the introduction of Reichsmarks in West Germany, and so they said it's not a war, and we're following the UN mandate to end the aggression. And at the first press conference, a reporter said, "So if it's not a war, what is it like? Is it a police action?" And Truman said, "Yes, that's exactly what it is." And that's what it was for the next 3 years.
What I found really interesting and fascinating was your background on writing about the coming up to the war. After World War II, there was a big desire to kind of cut back on the military, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there was. By 1949, the U.S. defense budget was lower than it had been in actual dollars in buying power in 1940, and when we were ranked 13th in the world or something at that point. The U.S. Navy had gone from 100 carriers to 5, and with the possession of the atomic bomb, they all said, "Well, we don't have to have wars anymore. If anybody causes any trouble, we'll wave an atomic stick at them." Or as one American put it to Russian Foreign Minister Molotov in a conversation, "If you keep it up, I'll pull a bomb out of my pocket and shoot you."
Which led the Russians to work feverishly on a bomb of their own.
Well, the Russians had been working feverishly since 1943, and they of course managed to surprise everybody in September of 1949 by exploding a bomb, which all of a sudden the nuclear monopoly was gone. But overall, the Air Force, the brand new independent Air Force who had been fighting for 30 years to get to that status said, well, we have the B-36. It can go anywhere, and we'll drop a bomb on anybody that causes any trouble. And everybody said, well, the only place that there'll be a war is in Europe, and the only reason we need the Navy is to transport the troops to Europe. And the Army said, and the Navy doesn't need its own army. We'll have the Marines in the Army. And that was what was going on after the Defense Act in 1948 that quote unquote unified the services.
Well, when it came to Korea, it was, I think you say it was almost like Pearl Harbor again. We were so caught off guard.
Yes, exactly. The U.S. Army in Japan had become an occupation force. A private who was making $25 a month in those days could afford a Japanese houseboy to press his uniform and polish his shoes and make his bed for him. And there hadn't been any military training of the Army since the war. An American general who'd been a hero in World War II arrived there as a division commander and tried to institute a field exercise for his men, he was met with almost a mutiny in 1949. and then when the troops got there, there's that wonderful thing about Americans and non-white people. We never think that those people can ever do anything, and so the American troops that were first put into Korea. Went, well, we'll just show up and they'll stop. But and the Americans thought, the American commander of those units said, these are raw recruits that we're going up against, and there shouldn't be any trouble. What they were going up against was an army of about 100,000 guys who had been veterans of the Chinese Civil War. And they got chewed up. It was just one retreat after another from the time they were introduced until they got down to the Pusan perimeter, and if it hadn't been for the Navy, they would have probably been thrown off the peninsula. By chance, the Navy had finally, in the spring of 1950, been able to put one aircraft carrier west of Hawaii, and that carrier was relieved in early June of 1950 by the only carrier in the Pacific that was carrying jet aircraft. So on July 4th, that carrier and a British carrier with 24 obsolete airplanes on it showed up 200 miles off of the Korean coast in the Yellow Sea and proceeded to bomb Pyongyang, which was 500 miles from the nearest U.S. air base. And the interesting thing that they militarily, the strike didn't do that much. It did blow up a few trains and such. But what it really blew up was an agreement that Stalin had with Kim Il-sung to give complete Russian air support to the North Korean invasion. The Russians backed off from that. And then those two carriers, over the course of the next 80 days, sailed around from one side of the peninsula to the other, providing air support. And when the Air Force couldn't provide air support from Japan that could stay over the battlefield longer than 10 minutes, these guys were like right offshore on call, and literally saved the Pusan perimeter. And since those days, nobody has ever said we don't need aircraft carriers.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I guess that's why, you wrote your book in some ways, because you wanted to give some credit to the Naval Air Campaign.
Yes, yes. The Korean War was the war that all of a sudden, all the reasons we had built aircraft carriers to be in battle changed, and ever since Korea, aircraft carriers have basically been mobile airports that we can send here and there as the situation needs it. And basically, for the 3 years of the war, the carriers were steaming in the Sea of Japan off the bomb line, bombing. Probably every guy who was there, who I've ever talked to, I said, "What was it like to be there?" And they say, "Did you ever see the movie The Bridges of Tokoe?"
We have some callers online with some questions that line up with at least Vernon Boyd. Let's go to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, one thing. Communist China actually started the war. Two, the reason that they were able to defeat us was the British Empire gave the Russians a jet engine that allowed them to build the MiG-15, which was superior to anything that was on the aircraft carriers. The B-29s could not get through. The B-50s could not get through. The B-36 was withheld for nuclear weapons. We had Okinawa and we had Taiwan. And if we had decided to, we had 300 or 400 nuclear weapons. And it was a matter of whether MacArthur got his way or Truman got his way.
You're very close to 100% there. What happened as far as starting the war? What has been discovered since the end of the Cold War, and we've been able to read what the other side was saying, was that in January 1950, Secretary of State Dean Rusk gave a speech in which he talked about the American interests in the Far East, and he said that, and he mentioned Japan, and he mentioned Okinawa, and he mentioned the Philippines, and he mentioned Guam, and what he didn't mention was South Korea, and so the Russians and the Chinese both looked at that and said, "Well, if he didn't mention it, it must mean that they don't really care." And just at that particular time, Kim Il Sung was in Moscow asking Stalin to support him to unify Korea, and Stalin said, "Go check with Mao, who happened to be in Moscow at the same time to sign the mutual defense treaty they were negotiating," and Mao said, "Well, it appears that the Americans don't care about Korea, so go ahead." and literally everybody except the Koreans backed into the Korean War, not expecting anything of what happened.
And
you're entirely right about the British Neen engine. It's very funny. The Russians were very late to jet technology. They didn't start trying to make jet airplanes until literally the end of the war, when they got hold of German technology. And the German engines were not that technologically developed. I mean, they were really good engines, but they were not technologically developed yet. And so they had their first two tries, the Yak-15 and the MiG-9, were failures. And then Andre McCoyan, who was one of the two designers, who happened to have a brother who was number three in the Politburo, said, "Why don't we go to the West and see to England and see if we can't negotiate the purchase of rights to produce an engine?" To which Stalin said, "Who would sell a jet engine to us?" And they said, "Well, let's go try anyway." And so the top Soviet aircraft designer and the top Soviet engine designer, both of whom were completely unknown in the West, were part of a trade delegation that went to England and looked at the Neen engine, which is the newest and most powerful engine Rolls Royce had come up with, and the Americans. I remember Corky Meyer from Grumman, who was participating in the development of the F-9F at the time, the Panther, said, "We started going nuts when we heard that the British were talking about negotiating the sale of a Neen. They had been they were in the process of trying to convince the U.S. to buy the Neen, even though it hadn't been invented here to use in the Panther, and it still happened. The British said. "Well, we have an agreement that it's only to be used for civilian purposes." So, what happened was that the Rolls-Royce, as we all know, builds wonderful machinery, but they build it hand-built. It's why the British Merlin engine in World War II was wonderful, but the engine that was reliable was the Packard built Merlin, which was productionized in America for mass production. So the Americans took the Neen and brought it over here and turned it into the J-42, productionizing it for reliability. And the Russians took the Neen and went to back home and productionized it as the VK-1. And later, when the British came up and said, you know, you built about 12,000 of these engines, could we have our royalty payments? And the Russians said, we had to redesign it so much that it's a brand new engine, and no, we're not going to pay you anything.
Oh, Thomas McKelvey Cleaver, our guest today. He is the author of Holding the Line, The Naval Air Campaign in Korea. Questions for him. We have some callers online, but there could be a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Talking about the Korean War today with Thomas McKelvey Cleaver, author of Holding the Line, The Naval Air Campaign in Korea. Great to have him with us. We'll take another call. John in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. What's on your mind?
A number of questions. In your evaluation of this war, did Eisenhower precipitate the end of the war by threatening nuclear war? My second question is, what's your feeling about why Truman fired MacArthur? Was it because MacArthur assured him the Chinese wouldn't get involved when we went north, and he also wanted to fight a nuclear war with China, which didn't have the bomb? Or was it that he insulted Truman as commander-in-chief, wanted his authority over Truman? And my last question is, I've heard conflicting reports on how many Koreans died in that war. I've heard 1 million Chinese, and I've heard 2 million Koreans, but then I talked to a good friend of mine who was involved in the war, and he said, no, it was more like 4 or 5 million Koreans that were killed. I just wondered if you could give me your opinion.
I would say right off the bat, your last question is an important one. Your friend who was there is probably closest. There is no real feeling for it. But the one thing to know is that the bombing campaign over North Korea with both the Navy and the Air Force dropped more bombs on North Korea than we dropped on Germany in World War II. In the first 90 days of the war, they dropped as many bombs on North Korea as they dropped on Japan at the end of the war. And it's estimated, literally, in North Korea, everything bigger than an outhouse, and probably a lot of outhouses, was knocked down, and then the rubble was bounced with more raids. And it's commonly believed that approximately somewhere between 15% and 20% of the North Korean population died as quote unquote collateral damage in the bombings. And that's the thing. That's important because, as we're talking about this as being the forgotten war, there are very few Americans who know that. Among people I know, I can count the ones who know that on one hand. But every North Korean knows that. Every North Korean alive has a story about somebody in their family surviving that. And that is why, for the last 65 years, they have been as hostile toward us as they are. And until we figure that one out and have something to say about it, I don't really think we're going to get anywhere with Kim Jong-un about ending their desire to have a nuclear threat to keep us at bay. Going back to the really important question that you asked was the question about MacArthur going north. What happened was the original UN call was for us to restore South Korea, for the North Koreans to move back north of the 38th parallel. And over the course of 90 days, by the 90th day, we had done that with the invasion of Incheon, which was probably MacArthur's greatest moment. MacArthur was a guy who was either an idiot or a genius. He had there was no switch in between.
I think you called him a brilliant military in the leadership situation, but completely untrustworthy politically. I think you said
that's exactly right. But he got there, and what had happened in those 90 days back here? Once again, all politics is local, as they say. During those 90 days of the war, what had been building here in America was McCarthyism, soft on communism. There's 150 guys in the state in the State Department. There's 85 guys. There's whatever. And so by the end of September of 1950, nobody could be seen as being quote unquote soft on communism. So as early as late August, the government had said, well, you know, we could move north and resolve this question by military means and unify Korea, and they proceeded to that. And at the same time, the Chinese were sitting there looking at Korea and saying, you know, everybody that's ever invaded us has come through the Korean Peninsula. And they kept, and they started in August saying, don't do this, don't come up here, don't bother us, leave us alone. And the Americans said, no, we don't have to worry about it. MacArthur was asked about it, and he said, I would remind the Chinese that no Asian army has ever stood against a Western army. And then the 2nd of October, Zhou Enlai brought the Indian ambassador Panikkar in and gave him an interview and said, if the Americans move north, if they cross the 30th parallel, we will intervene. And that was the point where the CIA said, well, they might send 40,000 guys to make a stand and then go home after having saved face, but they can't do anything anyway. And then somebody else said that Ambassador Panikkar was a pro-communist, even though he had a 30-year career as a guy on the political left who was an anti-communist. And the interesting thing is that all the guys who 10 years later got us involved in Vietnam as the big gargoyles were the low-ranking gargoyles in 1950, and they were saying, oh, everything will be wonderful. We can do it. Dean Rusk, who was at that time the Undersecretary of State for Far East Affairs, said, it will be easy. He virtually said the same thing as was said about Iraq, that they'll welcome us with flowers. and so they went north, and they were going through the entire month of October saying, well, we don't see anything. Because they didn't know anything about their enemy, and the Chinese had started crossing on October the 8th. Each soldier carrying an 80-pound pack with everything they needed. They didn't have trucks. They didn't have any. So the Americans are looking for a modern army coming south, and these guys are coming south, marching 15 miles a night with nobody smoking a cigarette, and then hiding during the days in the forest, and we don't spot them. And in the meantime, the Russians had said, "Well, we'll give you air cover of Manchuria," and so the MiG-15s started moving in October, and then everything changed in November, and basically what happened with the Chinese intervention in November, Sir Martin Gilbert wrote about that, and he called it the greatest defeat of a previously victorious army in recorded history. The U.S. Army on the western side were not allowed to retreat when they got hit. They got hit the next day after they began their victory offensive, and they ended up with a 150-mile retreat. That's the longest retreat in American history, and it was called by Dean Rusk the greatest defeat of American arms since the Second Battle of Bull Run. And by chance, by luck, the Marines in the east of Chosin held and managed to get out. But it was called forever the Big Bug Out by the Americans. There was an event with the 2nd Division who were held for 2 days that they could have gotten out, held on the Chong Chong River, and they eventually became what is known today in the division's history as the death ride to Kunari, where they lost 5,000 guys going through a valley where the Chinese were on both sides. And that by the time they got to the other end of the valley, that division was so badly chewed up that they wouldn't enter combat again until the following June.
And then
what happened was the Chinese got infected with the same disease we had in September, what the Japanese called victory disease, and right at the beginning of September, the Indians came up with this thing and they said, why don't you guys all just stop? You guys go back north of the 38th parallel, they stay south of the 38th parallel, everybody stops. And we'll even give you, Red China, the Chinese seat at the UN if you do this. And they didn't do it.
Yeah.
And so they moved south, and then finally the Americans were retreating. The Americans, it said that it was fortunate they retreated as fast as they did because the Chinese couldn't keep up with them. And they finally were able to hold in January of 51, and then between January of 51 and June of 51, there was a series of battles back and forth that finally established the main line of resistance on where things are at today. And in June, the Russians said, why don't we negotiate? And they spent the next 2 years with everything locked in on that line, with one side taking a hill and the other side taking it back, trying to do it. And as Admiral Tarrant, the character in Bridges of Tokyo Reef, said, one of these days, the communist negotiators will be sitting there, and someone will come in and say, they've even bombed the bridges of Tokyo Reef, and that day things will change. And basically, that's what the U.S. Navy did for the next 2 years, was try to find something they could bomb that would make the other side give up.
Give up. John, thank you again for calling. I want to give Madeline
Excellent questions.
Yeah, great questions. Madeline and De Pere, thank you for calling.
Hello. My brother, Vernon W. Cornelius, was in the Chosun Reservoir Battle. He was in the 1st Marine Division.
And oh, wow.
Recently, I visited a man named Jim Jolly, who lives over in King. And I brought him out to my cousin Frank Cornelius' Marine Museum, and they have a display there of the flimsy uniform they were sent in there with. And everybody sees MacArthur as a hero, but I don't think a lot of those Marines that went through the Chosun Reservoir feel that way, because they were sent in there totally unprepared, and they had to drop so many supplies into them because they did not anticipate the cold weather. Yeah. And it was just a nightmare what they went through.
Well, fortunately, the Marines had, for as bad as everything was, the Marines had an amazing amount of luck in there. For one thing, three of their top commanders were the only guys in the American military who'd ever been around the Red Chinese. Jesse Puller had been an observer of the Eighth Route Army in China in the Civil War in 1938, and so they had an understanding of how the other side fought, which nobody in the army had. And then by chance, the head of the quartermaster corps, the supply corps of the Marines, was a guy who in the 1920s, as a young officer, had experienced the Mongolian winter when he went there as exploring. And he was the one guy in the entire American military who said, we need to supply winter clothing. And they did supply winter clothing. The one thing that we found out was nobody knew how to make winter clothing that worked at 30 below. But they got the stuff. And the winter snapped. One guy told me that on November the 11th he went swimming in the reservoir. It was so warm. And the next day he woke up and his breath frosted his crystals.
Yeah. It's just absolutely amazing. Madeline, thanks for for that, Willie and Madison.
And thanks for your brothers, for surviving that.
Willie and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Willie.
Hi, and I certainly want to thank John for asking the questions that he did too earlier. I have heard only in years since, nothing since well after the Vietnam War crimes, I've heard that the U.S. bombed so much that they pretty much wiped out all North Korean rice paddy food production, like they later attacked Vietnam in the same way, and they also attacked... They did a lot to destroy the food production systems in the first Iraq War.
Yes, that happened in the starting in the summer of '53. They finally went after the electric complexes in North Korea. They had been holding back on that because some of the electric complexes also provided power to the Chinese in Manchuria. And then in the spring of '53, they bombed the dams, which maintained the agricultural water for North Korea, and they did. They wiped out about 80% of North Korean agriculture that was one of the reasons that the war ended when it did. But it was a terrible way to do it.
Yeah, but that's what they had in their mind. They thought, well, maybe we can end the war if we just starve them.
But literally, they were bouncing the rubble for two years. In the summer of '52, they attacked Pyongyang for 3 days with everything they had, a maximum effort. And there was and by the accounts of the Air Force themselves, there were no targets left worth bombing afterwards. But they continued to bomb Pyongyang.
Oh, Willie, thank you, Rick in Portage County. Your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I'm wondering, I thought I read one time that, at least at the outset of the war, that Americans actually used some World War II prop-driven, like Mustangs and Corsairs. And
oh, yes, they did.
Even some B-29s at times.
Throughout the war, as a matter of fact. What happened there was that they found out the Air Force had just changed the year before from having the Mustang, the F-51, to the F-80 Shooting Star, and there were no airfields in South Korea that the jets could operate off of. They were all dirt strips, and so the jets could fly from Japan, and they had 15 minutes over the battlefield before they had to fly back, and so they had about 50 Mustangs that were still left in Japan and the Philippines, and over the course of the first month of the war, they reequipped two squadrons with Mustangs, and then they called back 145 Mustangs from the Air National Guard, brought them to Alameda, California, put them on board the carrier Boxer, which set a record of 11 days and 35 hours to cross the Pacific. They went to maximum speed as soon as they went under the Golden Gate Bridge and held it till they got to Yokosuka, and those planes were used. They used Mustangs until about the spring of 1953. The Mustang was really not the best airplane for the duty, because whereas with the P-47 that had been used in World War II, which had a radial engine, you could knock a couple of cylinders off the engine of a P-47 and it would still get back to base. With a P-51, you could put a BB in the radiator, and 2 minutes later, the engine was going to overheat. And they took about 35% losses among the three groups that used Mustangs in the war in battlefield air support. One guy was remembered that every time I got into the airplane, I wished I was in a P-47. They tried to get some P-47, even just a squadron of them, and they couldn't do it because they couldn't support them logistically. So the Mustangs soldiered on until they were replaced by Sabres. And the Corsair the Corsair was the savior of Chosin and Pusan and the Pusan perimeter. The Marines had their Corsairs, and the Marines had developed and maintained the ability to do close air support to the point they could come within 50 yards of the front line successfully without bombing their own side. And within 10 days of being noted that they were going to go, they sent the 1st Marine Provisional Brigade to Japan, which included 3 squadrons of Corsairs that went aboard these 2 little escort carriers, the Sicily and the Badoing Strait. And within 48 hours of their arrival at the end of July, those Marine Corsairs were flying off the coast, were operating off the coast of South Korea and giving air support. And they gave such close air support that they saved the Pusan perimeter, and in getting out of Chosin, they were the force that kept the enemy away during the day, that allowed for the retreat. It got to the point by 1951 that army units were saying, could we please have some of those Marines come give us air support, because the Air Force doesn't do it that good.
Yeah, that sort of, I think you talk about ending, there was some talk about unifying the services.
Yeah.
And that sort of went away.
That went away after Korea. Yes, it did.
It did indeed. Well, in the end, you quote French historian Marc Bloch?
Yeah, Marc Bloch.
Yeah, what did he say, and why did you end on that?
I'd have to find the book again, but he basically was talking about the fact that those who don't understand history, it's been said by many, many people, he just happened to say it elegantly, which is why I quoted him, but basically it comes down to those who refuse to pay attention to history will never understand what's going on today.
Well, you've written a fascinating book, and we've just touched kind of briefly on it, Thomas. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and I much enjoyed reading your book. Thank you so much.
Okay, if I can make one little self-serving announcement. A lot of people talked about Chosin.
Yes.
And I also wrote a book called The Frozen Chosin, which goes into the history of how we got involved in Korea and the Battle of Chosin and what it meant to American forces. And it's still a good seller. So it came out in 2016. You can get it at Amazon.
Do you have a website, by the way?
No, I don't, but you can find me at Amazon. I do have a page there.
Okay. Thomas, thank you so much again. I really appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah. Thomas McKelvey Cleaver is the author, and we've just been talking about, and his book is, his latest book is called Holding the Line, The Naval Air Campaign in Korea. Fascinating read, and I was glad we had the opportunity to talk with him. Well, do you know what a lexicographer is? Our next guest is one, and she has written a new dictionary, and it's aimed at children, but I tell you what, I've looked through it, and it's thoroughly enjoyable to me, and I bet it will be for you as well. And that's not Flap Doodle. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We'll be back with our guest, Jane Solomon, in just a minute.